Hello everyone and welcome to episode 598 of So You Want to Be a Writer, the podcast that's all about writing and publishing. My name's Valerie Koo. I'm CEO of the Australian Writers' Centre, the world's leading centre for writing courses, and I'm your host. What have you been up to this week? I went to see a wonderful play. It was the Sydney Theatre Company's production of No Pay, No Way, and it was brilliant. In short, if you have the chance to go, or if it ever comes to your state, go. It's a play that is adapted from the original Italian play. Obviously, it's in English, though. This is the paragraph from the Sydney Theatre Company, so you know a little bit about what it's about. Prices are out of control, and so is Antonia. Sick of having barely enough to pay the gas bill, she leads an uprising at a local supermarket that sees a group of angry housewives shoplift till they drop. Now, with a pile of newly liberated loot, Antonia, played by Mandy McElhenney, who, you know, is a wonderful actress, of course, and very famous for being Rhonda in the Rhonda and Cartoot ads, and her best friend Margarita embark on a ludicrous, laugh-a-minute escapade to stay three steps ahead of the law. It was a fantastic performance. In addition to the play, I have also been immersing myself in all things still life. Yes, painting them. If you're new to this podcast, in addition to being a lover of words, I'm also an artist, and lately I've been painting still life. So of course I had to go to my favourite bookshop, you know, and combine the two passions, and buy the book Still Life by Amber Creswell Bell, which features a whole range of wonderful Australian artists who paint still life. Honestly, if you asked me a year ago whether I would paint still life, I would have definitely said no, just not interested, not my thing. But then sometimes you're just creatively led somewhere. And if you feel like checking it out, feel free to have a look at my Instagram, Valerie Koo, K-H-O-O. Now, I wanted to say that it's the same thing with writing. You might think that you're never going to write romance, or you're never going to write crime, or you'll never write in first person, or you'll never not write in first person, right? But if something piques your interest, or if you just feel that niggling thing inside of you, suggesting, you know, very gently to you that you should try something different, don't shut that little voice out, because it's doing it for a reason. And you may not end up writing an entire romance novel or an entire crime novel or a story in first person or whatever, but it may teach you a technique for something that you just really needed to know in order to move forward in your creative journey. So please do be open to those little hints that might be suggesting to you to try something different or try something new, that even if it seems a little bit out of left field. And amidst all of that right brain creativity, I've actually been poring over spreadsheets to give my left brain a workout. Why? Because, well, bizarrely, among all of the creative things that I do, I'm also on the board of a bank. So, you know, life is eclectic and interesting, and you never know what it's going to throw at you. Anyway, I hope you've been having a wonderful week so far. And now let's welcome Nat Newman, our resident writing tip provider and expert. What have you been up to this week, Nat?
Well, this week, the play that I've been rehearsing opens.
Rehearsing as an actor. So you didn't write this play.
No, I didn't write this one. This one's Shakespeare.
Okay.
It's an adaptation of Shakespeare. But yeah, that opens this week. So it's very, very exciting to finally put it in front of audiences and all that hard work, you know.
So what's the play?
Oh, it's The Ides of March, and it's a reimagining of Julius Caesar. And instead of being, it's quite funny actually, instead of being killed, Julius Caesar is cancelled. Yeah, so we're using our mobile phones instead of actually killing people. We're using our mobile phones to cancel people. So it's quite fun.
So who is the writer? It's not Shakespeare, obviously.
Well, it's based on Julius Caesar by Shakespeare, but yes. It's a local director here in Newcastle. His name's Derek Fisher. So he's adapted it for, to make it a bit more modern. And his goal is to sort of make it so people who would never normally go watch Shakespeare, or even people who'd never normally go watch theatre, can actually feel like, oh, yeah, I'll give this a go. So that's what we're hoping for when we open.
Oh, brilliant. And who's your character?
Oh, I play a very small role. My characters called Trebonium, and I'm with the nobles. And the way I'm playing it is I'm a bit of a upper class thug. Is how I'm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, is how I'm playing it. But it's a lot of fun. So I get to show off my shoulder muscles.
You're like Ray Donovan.
Oh, I don't know who that is.
No, it's okay. Liv Schreiber played him in the titular role of Ray Donovan. But yeah, kind of like a thug to the upper class, a fixer.
Yes. Yeah.
What's been your favorite role that you've played so far?
I definitely loved playing Scullery in a play called Road. Again, that was a bit of a thug role. You know, it's so interesting. I did a workshop a couple months ago, and the guy leading it, a fantastic actor, and I've got very big eyes. and he said, you're so expressive. He said, I bet you always get cast as a really nurturing person. And I was like, actually, I think mostly I've been cast as thugs. So I don't know how that happens, but yeah. But Scullery was great. Scullery was this kind of street pirate who, you know, roamed the streets and collected stories and you know, sat in the gutter and drank and got into fights. It was great. It was a really great role.
Have you ever had a role with an accent?
That one was that we had to be Northern English for that one. It was pretty tough.
Okay. So how did you master the accent?
I actually had a session with an accent coach first, and then she provided me with some resources, and then I literally watched a lot of YouTubes to try and get the accent. It's the best way to do it. But it's also why Australians we're known to be really good at accents, because we will just, we'll put in the work. We'll sit down and watch a bunch of videos and copy it. And it really, it's as easy and as hard as that. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. But it's very much about the formation of, it's where the words form in your mouth, isn't it? I was watching this YouTube video with Millie Bobby Brown from Stranger Things, and she was talking about how the English accent sort of at the back of the mouth, the Australian sort of in the middle, and the American is very much, it's at the front.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting just the where you form the words, whether it's the back or the middle or the front, really makes a huge difference in your accent. Yeah,
it does. And one thing that accent coaches will focus on is how you say So in Australian English, like we say because that's your relaxed kind of posture, right? So as you just said, like it's kind of in the middle. Whereas you watch someone like Amy Adams, who's American, and her will be like and it's really her
it's at the front, yeah.
And then you watch someone like Hermione Granger, I've forgotten the actor's name, and it's more like and so it's like it's at the back of, and you're almost pulling your lips back. So yeah, it's fascinating. It's I could watch accent videos all day. They're so interesting.
Yeah, it's so I find them really interesting as well. But let's move on to your writing tip for this week.
Right. So this week I just want to have a quick chat about grammar and punctuation. Now, so in one of the courses that I'm a tutor for the Writer Center is Creative Writing Stage One. And one thing that I do like to make sure that writers get a handle on is how to punctuate dialogue. Now, I try not to focus too much on grammar and punctuation, because obviously the focus on that course is on getting people confident and kickstarting their writing journey, getting them confident in writing fiction. But I do feel like dialogue is one of those things that it is handy to try and just nail it as soon as possible. And the reason for that is when you read dialogue, you need to know who is speaking. And if it's not punctuated properly, it becomes really difficult for the reader to figure out who is speaking. So obviously, Valerie, we have a fantastic course on grammar and punctuation, which if you do want to brush up on your fiction grammar and punctuation, it's specifically for fiction, you should check that out. However, my big tip that I always give to the writers in our course is just really pay attention when you're reading.
Yes.
Next time you pick up a book, really notice how dialogue is punctuated. And if you honestly, if you just spend 10 minutes intensely concentrating on how the dialogue is punctuated, you will see the patterns and you will go, oh, I get it now. And just like we were talking about with accents, it really is as easy and as hard as that. Put in the time, observe, oh, there's always a comma before the quotation mark is closed, unless it's a exclamation mark or a question mark. And you will learn. You can learn punctuating dialogue in 10 minutes if you just sit down and really, really, really critically examine whatever book you happen to have in front of you.
Yes, it's just a bunch of rules, and it's just follow the rules, and it's not even heaps of rules. It's a handful of rules, and just follow them. And you're right, there are so many examples literally all around us in the countless books. Just go to any bookshop or anything. But what's interesting though is that in Australian fiction, so Australian novels and books, there is typically single quote marks are usually used. But Australian newspapers, like the Sydney Morning Herald or the Australian or whatever the big newspaper is in your state, it's double quotation marks. So it does confuse people a little bit. However, with fiction, it's just a lot easier on the eye, I think, and that's why we use single quote marks, because then it's just a more seamless read kind of thing. So, in fact, both versions are correct at using double and using single quotation marks. It's just that you need to use them appropriately for the appropriate time.
And just be consistent, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So good thing to point out. Thanks, Nat, for your writing tip this week.
Thank you. I'll see you next week.
Let's move on to our competition this week. This week, I'm giving away three copies of The Murder Inn by James Patterson and Candace Fox, co-authors of the Detective Harriet Blue series. James Patterson is an award-winning author who has also co-authored best-selling novels with so many people, but also the likes of Bill Clinton and Dolly Parton. And Candace Fox is an accomplished crime fiction author and teaches at the Australian Writers' Centre. Her course is Anatomy of a Crime, How to Write About Murder, and it is very popular. You can also meet her on episodes 471 and 398 of this podcast. But here's the blurb so you get an idea of what the book is about. It's the perfect getaway, but the past will always find you. When ex-cop Bill Robinson takes over the inn by the sea, all he wants is a quiet escape from the city. But when a crime boss moves into town and begins terrorising Bill's friends, he can't just sit back and watch. It's not long before local criminals are turning up dead and the inn comes under attack. With the help of the inn's fearless residents, Bill must do everything he can to defend his town, his chosen family, and his home. So just go to writercentre.com.au/win for your chance to win one of three copies of The Murder Inn by Candace Fox and James Patterson. Entries close on 22nd of April. And don't worry, if you're at that URL in the future, there'll be some other fantastic competition for you to enter. That's writercentre.com.au/win. This podcast is brought to you by the Australian Writers' Centre, a world leader in writing courses. Our hugely popular course, How to Write About Murder, is all about creating more authentic action for your crime or thriller novel. Presented by award-winning crime author Candace Fox, this course covers 9 modules of fascinating detail, taking you beyond the police tape to explore what motivates killers and how they go about their business. You'll also immerse yourself in the chase, from the murder scene and autopsy to the investigation that follows. Plus, because it's one of our on-demand courses, you'll get instant access and learn at your own pace with 12 months access to all course materials. You can find out more at writerscentre.com.au/murdercourse. And now, are you ready for the word of the week? Well, I hope you are, because this week's word of the week is oneiric. Oneiric, that's O-N-E-I-R-I-C. Oneiric is a lovely adjective and it means of or relating to dreams. So you could say the oneiric landscape gave her chills as she tried to find her way home. There you go, oneiric. Try using that in a sentence this week. Now let's move on to our writer in residence. Mary Anastasio's latest picture book is Julius Squeezer. She is also managing editor of 5 Mile and is former creative director of Larrikin House. Mary has great insight into the world of picture book production, how the process works, what not to do if you're an aspiring picture book author, and the fantastic way she finds her illustrators. Mary, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's so exciting to finally meet you.
Well, likewise, I have so many questions for you because you are not only a successful picture book author, you are also heavily involved in the picture book industry because you are managing editor at 5 Mile Press.
I
And
am.
you've previously been creative director at Larrikin, which is also a fantastic house. So there are so many things I want to ask you about, but let's just start with your latest book, Julius Squeezer. What a great title.
Thank
Tell us
you.
what it's about.
Well, essentially, it's about a little python who hasn't quite figured out that squeezing isn't the right way to say hello to people. So he enlists his friends to give him some suggestions. And the reality is that he finds out in the end that there are others that are like-minded who just, need to help him with a little bit of practice. So yeah, that's what it's
What
about.
a cute story. What made you think of this?
Well, it's funny. I was saying to someone the other day, the initial concept came from a post or a meme that I'd found on Facebook where somebody had posted about a python at the New York Zoo called Julius. And I just found it hilarious. Like, the name inspired me and I just thought it was really funny. And then, interestingly enough, I've had some, my couple of my nieces have had little kids. So you go back into that. Watching toddlers learning how to kind of engage and interact with each other, and you see them pick up an animal and they squeeze it too tight, and you have to remind them not to like to be a bit gentle, or they're so excited to see their friends that they grab them by the neck and give them really tight cuddles. So kind of it was that sort of idea of just playing with that concept.
Now, tell me about your position at 5 Mile Press, managing editor. Can you describe to the layperson what it is you actually do?
Well, essentially, I'm currently in a support role to our publishing director, Kate Chisholm, and we kind of work together, basically looking through manuscripts, for example, going through the slush pile, finding something that we think is, potentially worth pursuing, and then working through that author illustrator process, finding an illustrator for that title, then doing the briefing, going through that process with them, making sure that, roughs are actually signed off and that sort of stuff. And then my job at the end is to potentially just do all of the design work and the artwork and prepare the files for print. So essentially, that's what I do. It's what
So,
I did at
when
Larkin.
you say, prepare the artwork and all of that, you're typically working with an illustrator, right? You're not actually doing
No.
the artwork.
No. So the way that it works is we'll engage an illustrator. And I will have either designed the typography and the illustrator works around the typography, or we do it the other way around, where the illustrator essentially designs the spreads. And then once the spreads have actually been finalized and we've been sent through the artwork, then I'll sit down and put my designer hat on and start playing with setting the files up for print and designing the text and the way that it flows and all of that kind of thing. And then the files get set up for production and they go to print. So, yeah.
And before you get to the stage where you're working through that process that you've just described, and working with the author and illustrator, what are you looking for to say yes to even get to that stage? What are you looking for when somebody sends in a picture book manuscript?
That's a really tricky question, and we get asked that all the time. It's one of those things. It's an intuitive thing, I think. And I think as publishers, I think we have to be really objective in terms of looking at a manuscript and saying, is this commercially appealing? Is there a market for this? Is there anything else on the market that is similar to? What's its unique selling point, or what is it that makes this a little bit different to something else? Does this stand out in the sea of manuscripts that are submitted or books that are actually out there? And I think it's such a competitive thing. It's one of those things. Sometimes you'll find something, you'll strike gold, and you'll just find something and go, yeah, absolutely. And everybody's in, and we know that it's fantastic. And sometimes you just don't. Sometimes it's you just take a risk on something that you feel that you really like. And it might not necessarily do very well in the industry, but it's an instinctive thing, I think. Illustrators are different though. Like, I know when I see a really good illustrator, I know straight away that I want to use them. it's a bit of a different sort of selection process.
So talk to me about that, because we do have illustrators who listen to the podcast. What are you looking for in an illustrator? Like, and how are you choosing them? When do they submit their portfolio to you? And if so, what are you expecting in a portfolio?
We don't get very many portfolio submissions because we don't necessarily open for illustrator submissions. I think when I'm looking for an illustrator, and I think all of the illustrators that I've found in the past have come through Instagram. And it's
As
one of
in, you found them,
yeah.
you've actually found them by accident on Instagram, or are you actively looking?
I actively look. It's one of those things. It's part of my job to actively look and see who I can find and be inspired by people. And it's one of those things when a manuscript lands on my desk, I've said this before, I kind of see things in pictures. So when I'm reading a manuscript, I visualize it and I kind of get a sense of what the illustrations need to really look like. So then it becomes a case of matching what I've got in my head to finding someone on Instagram that can actually do that. And it's a bit for me, and I think I've said this before, but for me, expression is really important. Like, an illustrator really needs to be able to communicate the visual narrative through facial expression, because we have to remember that, the kids that are actually reading these books, 9 times out of 10, they're not actually at reading stage just yet. It's really, really early days of reading. So they rely on facial expression to kind of communicate what's happening in the manuscript while they're listening to, an adult read. So facial expression is really important to me. And, bright colors and a really, special style, like a very unique style, is what I look for.
That is such an interesting insight about the expression is super important. Now, let's say you're going around on Instagram, you're looking at different things, and you go, "Oh, that person, that illustrator can do great expression, and I like the colors, and ticks all the boxes." But they may not have illustrated for a children's book before, which is also a very specific kind of interpretation of the text. So what happens then? How do you Do you, are you open to working with people who haven't illustrated for picture books before? And how do you then coach them to understand how to produce illustrations that are appropriate for a picture book text?
I can tell you that 90% of the illustrators that we commissioned for Larrikin House were first-time illustrators. That
Wow.
they'd never done picture
Well,
books before.
first-time picture book illustrators.
Yeah, first-time picture book illustrators, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
Wow.
I think one of the nice things about what I do is I like to try and build relationships with people, especially my illustrators. Like, I tend to baby them a little bit, if you know what I mean. So I'm very clear in terms of the briefs that I give them, and I like to make sure that they know exactly what they need to do in terms of, spec sizes for print, how big the pages need to be, how the files need to be supplied, how they need to color correct them to ensure that we get the best possible outcome at the other end. So yeah, there is a lot of nurturing that happens with first time picture book illustrators. So yeah, it's just something that it's part of the joy of doing the whole picture book thing. The whole illustration thing is where my joy lies, to be honest.
Are you looking for illustrators that are doing hand illustrate, like watercolor or paint or whatever, or are you open to digital illustrations?
We're open to everything at the moment. At this stage, not AI, because that just hurts my heart. But yeah, we're open to all mediums, digital, watercolor, pencil, whatever. I think it comes down to style, essentially, like finding the style that I think is going to translate the narrative as best as possible.
So now let's go back to so my original question, which was, what are you looking for in a picture book text, right? So let's go back to text, and I can understand how that is a little bit hard to define because it's like that X factor, right? But how about the things that are just big no-nos? Like, you receive something, you go, "Oh my God, I can't believe they did that," or just some big no-nos that scream out, "You really don't know what you're doing."
Well, that's a bit of a hard question for me, because I had a fart book published. So I mean, that's it, and it wasn't my intention to potentially write a fart story. It was just one of those things. But I think you know,
obvious. No, I think fart books are great. What do you? That's not a great example because fart books are awesome.
Some fart books are awesome. Some I think poo probably is.
I don't mean in terms of topic. I mean in terms of, you know, they've written in Comic Sans or they've demanded their choice of illustrator, that sort of thing. So not topic, but rather the way in which they present things to you, the way in which they deal with you, that kind of thing.
Oh, okay. I think probably the biggest no-no would be to submit manuscripts that haven't been edited properly, like just don't send through a brain dump. Like if you've got an idea for – you know, your manuscript, make sure that you flesh it out, make sure you then get it edited, make sure that you've really honed your craft, because sending just a brain dump is not going to...
What does a brain dump look like? What's in a brain dump typically?
Well, somebody might just... We sometimes get submissions where people go, I've got this idea for a story, and they give you almost a bit of a synopsis, but they don't actually give you the story, and you just, you go, okay, where's the rest of it? So that's potentially not the right thing to do. And then the other.
So you need the whole manuscript,
of course.
Yes,
yeah, of course. If it's a picture book, absolutely. I mean, it's 32 pages, really. So it's less than 400 words, 500 words. So I can't imagine it would be too hard. Well, you know, you have to really submit the entire thing. A synopsis isn't going to cut it.
How do you prefer it to be actually submitted? Like in a Word document with lines or separating, indicating the pagination, or on 32 pages or what?
I think it's probably the easiest way to do it is to work out how many pages your story actually is, and potentially paginate it. But just for example, like paginate the stanzas that you see on each of the pages is probably the easiest way to do it.
So just page one and then the text, and then page two and then the text.
Yeah. And that's relatively easy when you're doing something like rhyme, for example, when you've got, you know, a stanza that's two couplets each, whatever. You just, each stanza is a double page spread, for example. So in a 32 page, you've got 16 stanzas in your story. It's relatively easy.
So in terms of the picture book writers, just the ones who are providing the text, do you prefer them to send in their manuscript just the text, or do you like it when they say, oh, my best friend's an illustrator and here's the pictures?
Absolutely not. Like your best friend might be the best illustrator in the whole, or you might think that they're the best illustrator, but the reality is that your manuscript needs to come clean. It needs to stand on its own. We need to be able to look at it and decide where we think it needs to go. I think it's, you know, it's not one of those things that we potentially like to have author illustrators come in, unless they're an illustrator of a professional, you know, they've done things before, or they're really commercially viable, or they're a really well-known illustrator. Your mum or your sister or your nana, who you think actually is a really good illustrator, is probably not going to be picture book, you know, worthy, unfortunately. So yes, just your manuscript. That's all we want.
How did you get into picture books, and what do you love about them?
It's the falling into publishing backwards, Valerie. It's just
tell me about it. I want to know how you fall into it backwards.
Well, it was just one of those things. As I said, I'd gone on the self-publishing journey originally myself. So my first book, I Want to Be a Rockstar, came out in 2016, and I did all of those things. I've got a marketing background, have run a marketing agency for a very long time. And I got to a point where I'd done the publishing, I'd done all of the marketing, I'd done all the publicity, and then I got to a point where I kind of went, I really don't know what to do with it now. And I was raising a child and running a business and doing all that stuff. So I didn't really have a lot of headspace to focus on it. So sort of sat on it for quite a long time. And then out of nowhere, I got a message via LinkedIn. James Layton reached out to me and said, hey, I've just read this blog or this interview that you'd done. I know that you've got a book. Would you be interested in having a chat? So yeah, I got on the phone, had a bit of a chat to him, told him about the book, and he signed Rockstar, Movie Star and Sports Star. So he signed all three straight up. And it was just one of those things. He sent through the contract and the logo was on the contract, and I rang him and I said, is that your logo? And he said, yeah. And I went, no, it's not. So So I kind of went away and said, look, let me just redesign it for you, because if you're going into business and you're going into the publishing world and you're competing with all of these really amazing publishing houses, you need to be able to compete visually. So, you know, along came the yellow, the bright yellow and the smiley face, and it became the brand for Larrikin House and has become synonymous since, you know, you think Larrikin, you think the bright yellow. So
yes.
I kind of felt into it that way.
Oh, brilliant. And yeah. So you've written quite a few picture books.
Yes.
So we'll come back to Julius Squeezer, but I want to circle back to the farts. What is the fart book called again?
It's called Jimmy Bottoms, and it's the story of a little boy who wakes up in the morning, as we all do, and accidentally, you know, drops a fart and doesn't realize how destructive his fart is going to be. So fart has a tendency to just go out the front door, and he ends up at the farm and he curdles the milk and he breaks the eggs and he ends up at the hairdressing salon and it redoes all of the lady's hair and, you know, does all of these really, you know, naughty, naughty things. And then Jimmy realizes that he has to go and catch him. But how does one catch a wayward fart? So it's very cute.
I love it. And it's illustrated by Alex Patrick. And the thing is, that's a challenge to illustrate a fart.
Absolutely.
You know, with expression.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think he's done a wonderful job. Fart's very, very cheeky looking in terms of his expression. So, yeah.
All right. I have to ask, where did the inspiration for this book come from?
Look, he's 15, 16 now, but that book came when he was roughly 5 or 6. So, I mean, anyone who has boys or anyone who, you know, raises kids, obviously, he had sleepovers a couple of times and you could hear them from the other room doing the fart competitions and who could fart the loudest, and whether it was, you know, a shoulder fart, you know, the ones that they do, you know, with their shoulders or whatever, whether it was a real or whether it was a shoulder fart, it was just hilarious to them. So it just inspired that thought, you know, if there was a fart and it was wayward and it was destructive, how would one catch it? That's kind of where it came from, really. The silliness of listening to 6-year-olds.
I love it. All right, let's come back to Julius Squeezer. Now, I'd like you to comment on this as a managing editor as opposed to the picture book writer, right?
Yes.
So the, you know, it's going into production and now we need to commission an illustrator to interpret the text.
Yes.
What kind of brief as a managing editor, because as you say, a picture book writer often doesn't get to choose the illustrator the vast majority of time, often never meets the illustrator as well,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
So it's not like the writer can be briefing the illustrator. So what kind of brief does the managing editor give to the illustrator on something like Julius Squeezer?
Okay, so firstly, what I do with my authors is I ask them if they have any illustrator notes. So if there's anything that they've got in mind specifically in their manuscript that they would like to see interpreted, so whether that's something within the actual text that, you know, that had inspired them to write the story to start with, like if they've got any illustrator notes, I gather those first. Then what I do is
let's stop there for the moment, because with the illustrator notes, then define that, because there are some aspiring picture book authors who think they can write illustrator notes and they're dictating the actual picture that they want. So
So when you're submitting a manuscript, if you've got like minimal thoughts, or if the narrative requires some kind of explanation visually so that we as editors, when we're reading it, understand what you're thinking in terms of what you've written. If the narrative needs explaining and you need to put in one or two lines potentially to explain what the narrative is, then that's fine. But if you're going to submit your manuscript and you think that you need to give me, you know, pages and pages and pages of illustrator notes when you're submitting, forget it. I'm not going to read it. It's not going to happen. Yeah.
Yep.
I don't want to see illustrator notes until we've come to you and said, yeah, we're really interested in this. We're going to sign it. Once we've got a contract with you, then I will sit down with you and I'll say, okay, is there anything in the manuscript that you've actually got that you want to see specifically illustrated? Where is it? Do you have any illustrator notes? And that's when I go in and I go, okay, where? And give me maybe one or two or three lines within the manuscript that explains exactly what you think in that particular area, and I'll incorporate it with my thoughts. And then sometimes the truth is, from my creative perspective, I like to give out illustrators creative license to do whatever they want. So if the author has a couple of minimal points that they want to express, then I will pass those on. And then I essentially say to the illustrator, you do what you think. I think it's very right. important to let the illustrator do what they want.
Yes. So as the picture book writer, did you have any illustrator notes for Julia Squeezer?
Just one.
Yay. Well, very brief, very minimal.
Yeah. I think because I'd used Marina quite a few times before, I was very familiar with her style anyway. So the only feedback that I had, or the only bit of like suggestion that I had, was that I wanted it to have a little bit of an Easter egg that threw back to the idea of Julius Squeezer. So if you look at the cover of Julius Squeezer, on his tail, you'll find a really tiny little crown. That was the only thing that I asked her to do. Everything else was all her.
Wow. Okay. That's very minimal.
Yeah.
All right. Yes. Please continue with the process then of briefing the illustrator. You're going to give them illustrator notes as the managing editor.
Yes. So I will go through the manuscript. And as I said to you, when I'm reading a manuscript, I kind of get a visual idea of what I think it needs to look like. So I will give them some rough, for example, maybe I might say, it's a little bit difficult without a manuscript in front of me to kind of give you an idea of what I would say. But let's take Julius, for example. I would have potentially said, I would have given her some references to the kind of Python that I was looking at. I would have given her references to all of the animals that I talk about in the story. So we've got a morpho butterfly, we've got a leopard, we've got a howler monkey, we've got a sloth, we've got a couple of different animals within that story. So I would have given her visual references for those things. So, you know, when I'm briefing an illustrator, depending on, we've just done one recently called Maxwell Moth and the Bright Lights of Paris. And there were a couple of elements within that I thought, okay, this particular page, for example, they're riding through the streets of Paris. What I'd like to see is, you know, a Vespa, like a vintage Vespa with the Arc de Triomphe in the background.
Right.
So I might do things like that. But 9 times out of 10, it's just a case of, these are really some rough bullet points of what I'd like to see. You do what you want.
Yep. Yep, great. All right, so then how long does the illustrator have to draw up the roughs?
I'd like to say 3 to 4 months. What I'm finding at the moment with Five Mile, we're playing a little bit of catch up to try and get our lists a little bit up to date. We're a little bit behind in terms of our lists. So at the moment, we're looking between 8 to 12 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. And then after it, and is that the first, is that the roughs and you know, or no,
that's,
finished?
That's finished. Finished.
Really? So they don't give you sketches beforehand?
No, absolutely. So within that 8 to 12 weeks, we break it down. So we do a first round of pencil sketches, really rough. The illustrator sends those through. We have a look at them. We give the author an opportunity to make their comments on those. But then we go back and we ask the illustrator to do one refined illustration so that we can approve color work, make sure that we're happy with the palette, and that comes back to us. So this is all within their 12-week or 8 to 12-week brief.
Yep.
Once that is signed off, then we let them go off and do all of their color work. So within that 12-week period, at the end of the 12 weeks, we get all of the illustrations in.
Great. And what makes can you describe what you think is a difficult picture book author who may have a great picture book of course, because why would you have commissioned them in the first place otherwise, but then makes you go, okay, we're probably not going to work with them again?
Yeah. Look, I've had that situation before. And I think it's difficult when you have somebody who just isn't open to criticism or isn't open to hearing suggestions, and they're very fixed in terms of what they want. Or, as I said before, they come to you with, you know, 30,000 illustrator comments, or, you know, they want to be involved with the illustration process, or it just doesn't work that way. The industry doesn't work that way. You at some point need to hand over, let go and let God, as I say, and trust that the people that have taken over your book are going to do the right thing for you. You just have to let it go. I've also had authors who, for example, you know, see the pencil sketches and they want to make a million changes to the pencil sketches, which is fine first round, but then you're looking at it towards the end and we're almost at, you know, color stage, and they're wanting to make changes at that point, and you just go, no.
Wow. And is that just because of a lack of understanding of the industry? Why do you think that they are throwing their weight around like that?
There's two reasons. One, I think because there's, you know, new people that have come into the industry that aren't familiar with the process and that don't necessarily understand how it all works from a publishing point of view. They get signed, they're really excited, and I understand that position, and they want to be involved in that process. And the second part to that is, you know, as creatives, we get really attached to what we've produced, right? And we have this, sometimes we have a very, very strong idea of how we want it to look and how we want it to represent. And you just don't trust the process. That's what happens. You get really attached to the outcome. You get really attached to being involved, and you get really attached to your words. So sometimes, you know, you might be working with an editor and the editor will say to you, yeah, I'm not sure that line works very well, especially if it's rhyme. Yeah. Because rhyme can be very tricky. You know, you might say to someone that rhyme is slightly out, or that meter is slightly out, and they're just fixed on that line. They just don't want to change it because it's, you know, their work is fantastic, and that makes it really difficult to work with them. So you just go, nah.
So you combine your work as a picture book author with your work as a managing editor. Tell me about, as a picture book author, do you have like a goal of a number of books you want to publish every certain period or anything like that, or do you just wait till you're inspired?
I wait till I'm inspired. I can't, I'm just not, I'm not wired that way. I was actually saying to someone the other day that if I never had another book published, I think I'd be okay. It's wow. Just one of the things. It was, you know, the publishing journey, as I said to you, I kind of fell into it backwards, yeah? And it was because my son kept hearing me say, all I want to do is drink cocktails by the beach and write books, right? And he would hear me say that all the time, and he just looked at me and he just said, when are you going to make your dream come true, Mum? And it was like I had no choice. I had to show this five-year-old that if I really wanted something, I had to make it happen, yeah? So for me, Rockstar was the be-all and end-all. If had I not, you know, had anything else published after that, I think I probably would have been okay. And I'm okay. I don't know that I want to be the Aaron Blabies of the world, or, you know, I just don't know. I don't know.
I love how you did it to role model it to your kid. That is just so inspiring. That's so wonderful.
I had no choice. When your kid says, when are you going to make your dream come true? You have to show them that, you know.
Oh, my God. Okay. So my next question to you then, that dream came true and then some, because you've had several others published since then and are now, you know, heavily involved in the children's publishing industry. What's the next dream? What are you saying to your son now? I want to drink cocktails and?
You know, look, I think the ultimate dream for me would be, in an ideal world, I'd win Test Lotto and I'd start my own publishing company, and I would honestly, I would just produce books for the sake of the joy of it. Like, forget commercial appeal, forget appealing to the DDS, forget it. I don't care how many they sell. I would love to do that. I would just love to own a publishing company that just produces beautiful, beautiful books. That's it.
That is a gorgeous, gorgeous dream. I absolutely love it. Okay. Oh, look, and on that note, you know, congratulations on Julia Squeezer and the incredible work that you do at 5 Mile, and of course all of the other things that you're involved with. Thank you so much for your time today, Mary.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It was so nice to finally meet you. It's been great.
Big thanks to Mary for sharing her insights in this episode. People think that picture books are easy to write, but there's actually a lot more to them than meets the eye. And I love that so many graduates of our course, Writing Picture Books, take the skills that they've learned in the course and the frameworks that they need to understand that are so important to understand when you're writing a picture book, and they go on to become successful published picture book authors. Like Victoria McKinley. Let's hear what she has to say. This podcast is brought to you by the Australian Writers' Centre and our course, Writing Picture Books. If you'd love to create your own picture book, a popular 5-week course in writing picture books will show you how. Learn online and discover what you need to know about point of view, structure and pace, as well as language and rhythm, finding the right voice, working with illustrations, publishing options and much more. You'll also receive personalised feedback from your tutor on your writing. Let's hear from Victoria McKinley.
Hi, I'm Victoria McKinley. I'm a freelance writer and a picture book writer. And my debut picture book called Ribbit Rabbit Robot is out with Scholastic Australia. I know I'm really, really lucky because my work is completely flexible and I get to work around my daughter. So I'm still always there for pick up and drop off. And, you know, she inspires me. So, you know, she's kind of my muse. So I love spending time with her. I'm a total course junkie. I've done loads of courses with the Australian Writers' Centre. So the Writing Picture Book course really made my dreams come true. It was the beginning of my path to publication. I had wanted to be a published author since I was 3.5 years old and first started writing little stories. And, you know, it gave me all the skills and the confidence to write picture books and become published. The tutor had worked in the industry for years. She was just had a wealth of knowledge. So Ribbit Rabbit Robot began when I was bath time with my daughter. So she had been given a frog sponge for Christmas. We were kind of playing with that in the bath, so that was the ribbit. And then we were just playing with language, so other words that followed that kind of consonant combination. And we came up with rabbit and then, robot as well, and kind of set myself a challenge to see, can you actually write a story just using those words? And that's kind of where it all began. So for anyone who's thinking about writing picture books, I'd highly recommend the Writing Picture Book course. In fact, I do recommend it all the time to people that I meet that, you know, have an idea or are thinking about writing picture books, because, I mean, it is an intro, so you do learn the basics, but I think even if you had quite a polished manuscript, you'd still get loads out of it. And as I said, even hearing from the teacher who has so much experience and has worked in the industry, so kind of finding out the intricacies of the publishing industry is so helpful. And it will help you polish up your manuscripts further. There's no way you could do that course and not learn something that would take away and make your manuscript stronger.
Find out more at writerscentre.com.au/picturebooks. Okay, so I'm going to leave you with this fun fact. The semicolon is one of those pieces of punctuation that, you know, some people are a little bit afraid of, you know, because they don't want to use it incorrectly, so then they don't use it at all. The semicolon actually has a rich history. Introduced in printing as early as 1496 as sort of like an intermediary punctuation mark between a comma and a colon. In his book on English grammar, poet Ben Jonson said in 1640 that a semicolon is somewhat a longer breath compared to a comma, and that you need breaths in sentences to help you understand them. And I love this. It's from The English Primrose, written by Richard Hodges in 1644. He says, "At a comma, stop a little, semicolon. At a semicolon, somewhat more, semicolon. At a colon, a little more than the former, semicolon. At a period, make a full stop." Of course, these days in English, the semicolon has a more defined use than simply breathing. It's most commonly used to separate two independent clauses where you don't want to use a conjunction like an and or a but you also don't want to separate them completely with a full stop. They're also very useful, of course, in separating items in a complicated list. So don't be afraid of the semicolon. And by the way, the common plural of semicolon is semicolons, but you can also say semicola, which is what I'm going to call low-calorie soft drinks from now on, semicola. There you go. There's your fun fact for the week. Thanks so much for hanging out with me this week. I really appreciate it, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. Feel free to connect with me on social media. I'm at Valerie Koo, that's K-H-O-O, on Twitter, although I'm not in Twitter that much these days, Instagram, and of course, feel free to check out my personal website at valeriekoo.com, but join the listener community for this podcast on Facebook. Just search for So You Want to Be a Writer podcast community on Facebook and request to join. It's free to join. Love to have you in there, and I love the chats that are going on in there. Thanks for listening, everyone, and I look forward to chatting to you again next time. Thanks for listening to So You Want to Be a Writer. You'll find the show notes at writercentre.com.au/podcast, or sign up for our awesome and often hilarious weekly newsletter at writercentre.com.au/news, where you'll find writing resources, giveaways, competitions, and much more.